Throughout the 50 days of Easter, sacred music for the world. LutheranPublicRadio.org. Listen 24/7 to sacred music for the Easter season. LPR, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Mr. President, St. Paul in the Bible exhorts us to pray for our leaders, and that we do every Sunday.
Isn't it ironic? Today we have some human being that's supposedly supposed to show that we're primitive and ape men, named after a man who apparently understood the creative work of God in creating us and everything else.
Theologians are not theoretical physicists. We're not looking for new ways of understanding what God has revealed. We know what He has revealed. So creativity's great. Novelty, no.
When you wait, then there's two ways that you can wait. You can wait with fretting, or we wait with this sort of expectant, hey, it's not my job to decide when this is up. It'll be up when it's up. That's God's decision and His rule.
Missouri dairy farmers love issues, etc.
If you assume from the get-go that Jesus didn't rise from the dead, the resurrection that is at the heart and center of the Christian faith didn't actually occur as it is recorded to have occurred in the New Testament, you still have a couple things to explain or explain away, like every person who went to his tomb on that first day of the week found it empty. His body was not there, or his body was never recovered. If someone had simply misplaced it or taken it away, sooner or later someone would have produced a body to prove that Jesus had not risen from the dead. And then you also have to explain how it is that at the testimony of many hundreds, he appeared alive for some weeks after his crucifixion. We're going to be responding to some of the objections to Christ's resurrection. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. coming to you this Monday afternoon, April the 27th. Thanks for tuning us in. Dr. Adam Francisco will be our guest for the first half hour. Pastor Peter Bender joins us after that for our series on Lutheran catechesis today, the sacrament of the altar and the feeding of the 5,000. Then it's Issues Etc. listener email and comment line. That email address, talkback@issuesetc.org, and the Issues Etc. listener comment line, 618-223-8382. Joining us to respond to some objections to the resurrection, Dr. Adam Francisco, Associate Professor of History and Political Thought at Concordia University, Irvine, California, author of a recent column for the Lutheran Witness magazine titled Answering Objections to the Resurrection, and co-editor of the book The Resurrection Fact. Adam, welcome back.
Hi, Todd.
Let's start with probably the most robust of all the objections, and that is the naturalist objection to the resurrection. How would you describe it?
First of all, it's probably the most common objection, and it lies underneath all other objections. That is to say that those who reject that the tomb being empty on Easter morning is at best accounted for by the resurrection of Jesus, for them, for most people that don't believe it, they assume that miracles can't happen. So they come up with other theories to explain the empty tomb because the evidence is so compelling that there was an empty tomb on Easter morning, and there's lots of good eyewitness type of accounts and other sorts of evidence for it. So the naturalist assumption is pretty common in our culture, has been ever since the Enlightenment. And it basically starts with an assumption, you could say a faith-like assumption, that all there is nature, and nature is all there is. So everything that happens has to be accounted for by natural causation or natural means. And that's sort of in universities or areas of higher ed, that's the assumption everywhere. But at the bottom, it really is a faith type of assumption. That like Carl Sagan in that old PBS special, Cosmos, says that the cosmos is all there is, was, never shall be.
So what is the basic problem with the naturalist objection?
I mean, I guess there's a couple problems, but the biggest problem in terms of trying to explain why the tomb was empty on Easter morning, which is a basic fact that most historians, not all, but most historians will acknowledge, whether they're a Christian or non-Christian. But the issue is the evidence is so overwhelming that to account for that empty tomb, you have to go with the resurrection. There's no other way of explaining it if you follow the evidence. So the naturalist assumption applied to the issue of the resurrection rides roughshod over all the evidence. And it really, I mean, to put it in, I guess, scientific terms, it really is not a scientific approach to this historical question of what accounts for the empty tomb if you're ignoring massive amounts of evidence.
What is the swoon theory of the resurrection?
The swoon theory, well, you can trace its origins back over a century, but it became popular around the 1960s with a book called The Passover Plot that argued that when Jesus was tried and then tortured, he basically passed out or he swooned. And then he was put on a cross. And when he was hanging on the cross, you know, he's still alive, but eventually his heart rate decreases significantly. And for all intents and purposes, everybody looking at him on the cross believed he died. But in fact, he had just passed out again. And when they take him down from the cross, they put him, the theory goes, they put him in the tomb. And while he's in the cool of the tomb, he revives and then comes back. I don't know how he's able to roll the stone away, but he comes out of the tomb. And there's a number of different theories on what happens to him next. Some go so far as to say that he began wandering eastward, looking for the lost tribes of Israel, and eventually ended up dying in India. But the interesting thing with the swoon theory in light of the evidence is the Journal of American Medical Association did a study going back maybe three or four decades, that looks at all the evidence for Jesus' crucifixion and says that there's just no way Jesus could have survived the flogging he received, hanging on a cross, and certainly the final stroke verifying or asserting his death is when the spear was thrust in his side and blood and water flowed out or came out. And medical experts say that that was suggest that his heart was pierced, or the pericardial sac right around the heart was pierced, guaranteeing his death. So there's no way he could have just simply passed out. There's other problems associated with this notion that he may have passed out, such as the one I mentioned earlier. There's no way he could have rolled a stone after being beaten within an inch of his life that maybe weighed a couple tons. So even though it goes back decades and it's been discredited, like a lot of these contemporary theories have been, it still gets new life in popular authors.
You say that the swoon theory is essentially a conspiracy theory, or it relies upon a conspiracy theory. What do you mean?
Well, so looking at a historical event, the way a historian's normally going to approach what did or didn't happen in history or what caused something to happen is they're going to look at all the evidence and do their best to put aside any sort of presumptions of what actually did happen. They just look at the evidence as neutrally as humanly possible and let the evidence tell you what actually happened. But what contemporary objections to the resurrection do, like the swoon theory, is they assume to begin with an explanation. That is, Jesus could not have risen from the dead. And then they take piecemeal evidence to support whatever conclusion, like the swoon theory or some other theory, to support that particular claim, ignoring all sorts of other evidence. It's similar to this old Greek myth of Procrustes. You know, if your listeners have heard of the Procrustean bed, where this bandit has this ironclad bed and he kidnaps people from the side of the road. The bed is sort of a metaphor for a theory. And as this bandit Procrustes puts people in his bed, if they're too short to fit his bed perfectly, he stretches them out and forces them to fit in his bed. Or if they're too long, he starts cutting off limbs to force them into his bed. That's kind of what conspiracy theories do, is they ignore evidence or they manipulate evidence to confirm a a priori assumed theory about what happened in the first place. And in addition, conspiracy theories typically, if not always, are not falsifiable. That is, they're not open to being tested or proven false.
I want to come back to one point with regard to the swoon theory, Dr. Francisco, and that is the notion that Roman soldiers would permit a man who is sentenced to be killed by their governor to get off the cross alive. How credible would that be?
It's almost laughable that people would believe that. But it's sort of like, I mean, there's a similar thing in neo-Darwinian evolutionary theory, where I once heard David Menton, who I know is on your show not infrequently, somebody asked him, well, why would people believe in this, you know, the Darwinian view of evolution? And his response was simply, well, how else could it be? And what he meant by that is, given the naturalist assumptions of, in his field, biological sciences, this is the best explanation. And for, in the case of the resurrection of Jesus, given the naturalist assumptions of historians, I would say more polemical or ideological historians, the only way to explain it is through these various theories that try to undermine the historical and physical resurrection of Jesus. So it's the rejection of Jesus' resurrection is, I don't know, 95% of them, while they might cite some sort of evidence, they really are not conclusions drawn on the consideration of all the evidence. They sort of cherry-pick evidence to support their conclusions. If you look at all the evidence from the first century in and around Jerusalem, from eyewitness testimony and everything else, the only conclusion you can draw historically is that the empty tomb is accounted for by Jesus' resurrection.
One of the earliest objections to the resurrection is found in Matthew 28. What is it?
Yeah, that's the story. You know, after the tomb is empty, the guards run back into Jerusalem, and they're basically paid off to circulate the story that the reason why the tomb was empty is because the disciples came in the middle of the night and stole the body. That's the earliest one, and the only other, at least in terms of historical evidence goes, evidence contrary to a physical resurrection from the dead. But we're told in the Gospel of Matthew, and for up until about the later part of the second century, maybe into the third century, that story did circulate quite a bit. You find it in Justin Martyr, and I believe in Tertullian as well. But it just, I mean, we're told in the Gospel of Matthew that it was cooked up by the authorities in Jerusalem to keep people from believing that Jesus, in fact, rose from the dead.
We are responding to resurrection objections. Dr. Adam Francisco is our guest, co-editor of the book, The Resurrection Fact. When we come back, some would assert that Jesus' disciples, the Romans, moved the body or identified the wrong tomb. Well, how credible is that?
Throughout the 50 days of Easter, sacred music for the world. LutheranPublicRadio.org. Listen 24/7 to sacred music for the Easter season. LPR, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Concordia University Chicago is committed to keeping college affordable for all, and especially for LCMS Lutherans. We have scholarships available specifically for students who are LCMS members. This is Dr. Russell Dawn, president of Concordia Chicago, asking you to encourage your student to check out Concordia Chicago at cuchicago.edu. And if you are interested in supporting these scholarships, please find us online at foundation@cuchicago.edu.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Historic St. Paul Lutheran Church in the heart of Austin, Texas is glad to support the work of Issues Etc. I'm Pastor Brian Wolfmuller, pastor of St. Paul, and I'm glad we're part of this effort. Issues Etc. for decades has been the premier voice of Lutheran doctrine and biblical teaching in all of the world, and we're glad to be a little part of making sure that the work continues. If you're ever in Austin, stop by and visit us. All the information is on the website, stpaulaustin.org. That's stpaulaustin.org.
The world around us is laser-focused on the fear of death and disease. The April issue of the Lutheran Witness has the answer, Jesus and his resurrection. In this issue of the Lutheran Witness, Dr. Adam Francisco answers objections to the resurrection. The Reverend Sean Denzer discusses resurrection hymnody, and there's so much more. If you're worried about death, then take the opportunity to read about life in Jesus and his resurrection. Visit cph.org/witness to subscribe today. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the world from a Lutheran perspective. cph.org/witness.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're responding to resurrection objections. Dr. Adam Francisco is our guest, author of a recent column for the Lutheran Witness magazine titled Answering Objections to the Resurrection. The Lutheran Witness interprets the contemporary world from a Lutheran perspective. It's available in print and online, and you can find out more at cph.org/witness. The Lutheran Witness magazine, cph.org/witness. Dr. Francisco, regarding that story that you mentioned before the break that was cooked up in order to kind of dissuade people from believing in the resurrection, how do you respond to the idea that Jesus' disciples, or maybe even the Romans, moved the body, or that they may have identified the wrong tomb?
Well, I mean, that's another popular theory these days. My basic response is, what evidence do you have for that? Does it even make any sense? There were people who had the means, motive, and the opportunity in and around 30 to 33 AD to expose the claim of the early Christians that Jesus rose from the dead. They certainly were in a position to do that, and there's just no evidence that they tried to expose it as a myth or a hallucination of the disciples. There's no evidence for it.
So in other words, if the Romans were complicit in somehow moving the body, and that got misinterpreted as a resurrection, they could have easily, or the Jewish authorities, they could have easily produced the body.
Absolutely. I mean, that would have been real easy. But you don't find any instance of that. There was John Dominic Cross, and years ago, wrote a biography of Jesus where he suggested that if there's one thing we could know for certain that Jesus did, or that took place in Jesus' life, is that he was crucified on a Roman cross. But then he goes further and says, what happened to him, his body afterwards? We don't know. He was probably just discarded in just a trash heap somewhere outside of Jerusalem. And which is sort of interesting, because in his biography, he's basing his evidence for the life of Jesus on the New Testament documents, in particular the Gospels. But when it comes to what happens after his crucifixion, he doesn't follow that evidence. He comes up with some other explanation. I suspect I don't think that this is at all the case, but if he was thrown into a trash heap, perhaps an argument could be made that maybe that's why the Roman authorities or the Jews couldn't have found him. But there's just no reason to even consider that as history.
Perhaps one of the most far-fetched objections to the resurrection is one you just mentioned a moment ago in passing, the mass hallucination theory. How does it go?
Again, like these others, there's a lot of these types or versions of this theory floating around. But in short, hallucination theory does acknowledge that a tomb was empty on Easter morning, and it also acknowledges that the earliest Christians, Jesus' followers, the disciples, the apostles, the earliest Christian community in and around Jerusalem really did believe that they saw Jesus walking around alive after his crucifixion. And so the way, in order to get around that conclusion that, oh, that means he must have risen from the dead, the naturalists will say, well, we've got these facts, an empty tomb, we've got people claiming Jesus rose from the dead, we've got to be able to explain these facts appealing to natural causes as opposed to supernatural causes. And so for them, those who put forward this theory, the best natural explanation is that the people who claim to have seen Jesus must have hallucinated. And we know people in traumatic or kinetic circumstances do hallucinate. They see visions and so on. But we don't find any evidence, no psychologist has found any evidence that dozens, In the case of the early Christians, hundreds, Paul says more than 500 people would have the same hallucination where it's all very comparable or similar. There's just no evidence for that. So if there was some sort of mass hallucination where everybody, disciples, apostles, the early Christians, saw the same exact thing, that itself would be kind of a miracle.
Is there any substance to the idea that the biblical resurrection account was somehow borrowed from non-Christian resurrection? As some people point out, that there's, as you say, an uncanny resemblance between some ancient Roman myths and the resurrection account. What are they?
Yeah, so the probably the most popular one, the most uncanny one, is this myth that comes from ancient Persia. We don't know exactly when it began, but hundreds and hundreds of years before Christianity, the myth revolves around a Persian deity called Mithra. And the evidence we have of what Mithraism looked like in ancient Persia is really scant. When Mithraism makes its way westward into the Mediterranean world around the time of the Roman Empire, about 150, 200 years after the life of Jesus, all of a sudden Mithraism starts positing that Mithras was born on December 25th, had 12 disciples, rose from the dead, and so on and so forth. And so there have been some historians, and going back at least a century and a half, who said, oh, it must be that the early Christians borrowed from this Persian myth, and there's Egyptian myths as well that aren't as specific but come close. The early Christians must have borrowed from that and came up with their own myth and just replaced Mithras or Osiris in Egypt with Christ. Now, the interesting thing is, at least as far as the evidence goes, the historical evidence, that the story of Mithra and all the similarities to the narrative of Jesus' life, those were all added to the pagan myth after it was influenced by Christianity. So the claim that Christians borrowed from earlier myths, it's actually the opposite that we see in the historical record, that pagan myths copied Christianity.
Was that kind of a counter-apologetic on the part of the pagans, or was it simply they found the actual account more compelling than their own myths?
That's hard to say. Justin Martyr, he's the, to my knowledge, so he's mid-second century Christian apologist. He's the earliest to address this claim, and he suggests that those followers of Mithraism, because they saw Christianity, the popularity of Christianity, they too wanted to make their religion popular, so they started taking their cues from Christians to make Mithraism more popular. But I think it probably needs to be said again that Mithraism, as uncanny as it is, as close as it gets to teaching some of the same things as Christianity, all those similarities are things that we don't find in the historical record until the second century, suggesting strongly and more probable than not that it derives or it's developed from the influence of Christianity.
Do the gospel writers or any of the other New Testament authors ever give the impression that they regarded the resurrection as mythical?
No. There's not a single trace of evidence. In fact, in 2 Peter, it's pretty that the author pretty clearly states that we did not follow cleverly devised myths, but rather what this is me paraphrasing, but what we pass on to you, we saw with our eyes, we touched with our hands, to borrow from other New Testament writings.
And I do note, finally, Dr. Francisco, that all of these objections either concede or have to somehow explain away that empty tomb, the fact that what everyone who went to that tomb found when they actually, in some cases, looked in or climbed in, was nobody.
Yeah. There's a Christian apologist named Gary Habermas, who I believe you've had on your show in the past, who his whole apologetic approach is oftentimes called the minimal facts approach to the resurrection of Jesus. And what he does is looks at just the basic facts that all historians, with the exception of, let's say, History Channel type historians who are quick to jump to alien explanations and so on, but general historians, regardless of religious persuasion, what facts they acknowledge. And one of those facts is that the tomb absolutely was empty on Easter morning. And then you look at the testimony of those who went to investigate the tomb or climbed into the tomb, and it's really remarkable how the gospel writers, who are trying to persuade, as John puts it in chapter 20, that its readers or its hearers that Jesus was the Christ, the Son of the living God, that they put in their narratives of the appearances after Easter morning that the women were the first to see Jesus. Now, if they're trying to persuade their audience that this is all true, the last people they're going to use as evidence or eyewitnesses are women, at least in the first century Jerusalem. And yet they kept it in. And nobody tried to change the text later on because they were interested in reporting, as Luke puts it in his prologue, what really happened in Jerusalem around the time of Jesus' crucifixion and resurrection.
Dr. Adam Francisco is Associate Professor of History and Political Thought at Concordia University, Irvine, California, co-editor of the book The Resurrection Fact, Responding to Modern Critics, and author of a recent column for the Lutheran Witness magazine titled Answering Objections to the Resurrection. Dr. Francisco, thank you.
You're welcome.
When we come back, Pastor Peter Bender joins us. Our series on Lutheran catechesis continues. We're talking about the sacrament of the altar, and this time we'll explore it in terms of the feeding of the 5,000. I'm Todd Wilkin. Stay tuned. I've written a column for the latest Issues Etc. journal titled Closed Communion, Biblical, Historical, Lutheran, and Loving. We'll send it to you for free. Just click the red journal subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, Dr. Nancy Almodovar writes about her journey from the profound doubt produced by her former Calvinist beliefs to the absolute certainty of Lutheran theology. The free online Issues Etc. journal, issuesetc.org.
Lutheran Federal Credit Union serves the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod community with car and personal loans, mortgages, credit cards, checking and savings accounts. Lutheran FCU supports LCMS organizations with its Spotlight Ministry program, and Lutheran Federal Credit Union allows you to make purchases with Apple Pay, Google Pay, and Samsung Pay using your digital wallet. Learn more at LutheranFCU.org. Good for you, good for the church, Lutheran Federal Credit Union, LutheranFCU.org.
Looking for a foreign language program that will revolutionize your students' vocabulary knowledge and their understanding of grammar? How about a program that teaches critical thinking skills, too? Look no further than Memoria Press's Latin curriculum. Students of all ages can use these Latin study programs. Give your students the gift of Latin today. To order, visit memoriapress.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR20. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
It is the greatest adventure you could ever possibly imagine. It's demanding, it's hard, it's challenging, and what a blessing it is.
Dr. Larry Rast, president of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, on why a man should consider the vocation of pastor.
And it is an incredible blessing to be honored with the opportunity to work with these incredible young men and older men as well, who are committing themselves to the proclamation of God's Word, the right distinction of law and gospel, and to take the good news of Jesus Christ into all the world.
You can find out more about studying for the pastoral ministry at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, at ctsfw.edu or call 1-800-481-2155. Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, forming servants in Jesus Christ who teach the faithful, reach the lost, and care for all.